Members of Congress are in the midst of their traditional August break, but in just a few short weeks, senators and members of the House of Representatives will head back to Washington. They'll resume work on crucial legislation to shape our nation's public policy. Every year, Congress tackles vital issues like government funding, foreign relations, taxation, nominations, and much, much more. The decisions they make have an enormous impact on how we live and do business nationwide and in Wisconsin. Welcome to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward. We extend a special welcome to listeners of Simply Superior in the Twin Ports, giving us an insider perspective to all of this, plus helping us understand how Congress works, is U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany. Tom represents Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District in Washington. Congressman Tiffany, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to have you.
Shereen, it's good to be with you today.
Yeah, well, there has been a lot happening. There's always something to talk about when it comes to national policy. So let's get into it. First, right off the bat, I want to talk about this. There has been some discussion about potentially holding a vote to impeach the president. Will that happen?
That's a good question. Some members are advocating for that at this point. What I've said to people pretty consistently in regards to this issue, I actually believe that Democrats handled this improperly with President Trump. I view it as a ready, fire, aim situation that they did, where they said, we're going to impeach you. Because if you remember back when President Trump was inaugurated, that day, the Washington Post said that impeachment may be in the future. And so there was just this whole thing about, okay, we're going to impeach, and then we're going to find out the facts to support that impeachment. And that's why I say ready, fire, aim. I think it's very important. Everyone is innocent until they are proven guilty. I do think that there's very compelling evidence that is starting to come out, that has been coming out for a number of months in regards to President Biden and his family. I mean, so far, it's been shown there's been $20 million worth of transactions. There were over that went to the Biden family. There is like 20 shell companies that the Biden family created. You have the IRS whistleblower who said, Gary Shapley, who said that I was not allowed to do my job and follow this to its end point. He believed that he was stifled by the Department of Justice of being able to get that information. And then, of course, it was 2 weeks ago that Devin Archer, Hunter Biden's business partner, he basically corroborated that evidence that said, yeah, these transactions were going on from places like Russia, Kazakhstan, China, places like that.
So how does the impeachment process actually work? I mean, what happens?
So if you listen to the things that Speaker McCarthy's been saying here recently, he's been talking about an impeachment inquiry. And that is different than impeachment. It is building the facts to, should there be an impeachment? Should the House vote on impeachment? Now, I was not there for the Trump impeachments, and certainly not there for any other impeachments that happened throughout history. But my understanding is that you have the inquiry, and then it's decided whether you actually have the impeachment vote. And that's what Speaker McCarthy's been talking about, is let's have this inquiry, let's have this fact gathering. And I think that's really important for the American people to understand, okay, has this risen to the level where there should be an impeachment vote?
We'll be watching that carefully for sure. I want to talk about some of the legislation that you've either sponsored or co-sponsored. The first is the Access Rural America Act. What would that do, and why do you think it's important?
So I want to make sure that I have the right bill there. I believe that is in regards to broadband providers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so what we have is some of the so we have some of the small telecoms that are out there. Especially in rural America, they have hit a cap in terms of the number of shareholders that they have, where they have to go through significantly higher review, regulatory review, by the can't remember which department, but one of the departments. They have to. There's a much more rigorous process they have to go through, and it's serving as an impediment for them to be able to deploy the capital that they have to put in more rural broadband. I mean, that's not a good thing to be happening. And so we're trying to ease that cap, to change the law so that the number of shareholders, it's a rather esoteric issue, but where you can raise the number of shareholders that can be in that company and not have to comply with these really excessive, I would call draconian regulations, we're trying to offer them some relief so that they can deploy those assets.
And what are you hearing from your colleagues across the aisle? Is this getting some bipartisan support?
Yeah. There's been support. In fact, I believe it's former Representative Axne from Iowa, who's a Democrat. She was defeated last election, but she introduced this bill. So it has been largely bipartisan to get support for that. Okay. But really important for rural America.
Sure. What about the Milk Act of 2023? That caught my eye. Everybody loves milk, right? So what prompted that?
Yeah, so the Biden administration is proposing that there not be chocolate milk allowed in our kids' schools. Okay. And they actually titled it flavored milk. But it's primarily chocolate milk. And we're just like, why would you try to forbid chocolate milk from being served in our schools? Now, the rationale behind it is that chocolate there's more calories, there's more sugar in there, and that's why that should not be allowed. It should simply be white milk. But I think on the whole, having kids drink milk, whether it's white milk or chocolate milk, is a good thing. And especially coming from the dairy state, we kind of take umbrage when you say that we shouldn't be consuming milk in our kids' schools. And so we have a bill that would forbid the Biden administration from enacting that. And this kind of takes me back, Shereen, to when you think about, this is one of Michelle Obama's really pet projects that she really dug into when President Obama was in office, where she wanted to dictate from the federal level what we should be serving in our kids' schools. And I'll never forget that a school lunch manager in a school district here in northern Wisconsin, I was in the state senate at the time, came running out to me one time when I was at a gas station filling my tank saying, would you tell them not to do this? We're going to end up throwing away far more food than if you just let us, just allow us to be able to serve healthful nutritional meals. And I've heard from a number of food service directors, including Superior, Lakeland Union, and others that are like, really just leave us alone and we will make sure kids have good meals. At the end of the day, I think in terms of the bigger picture, Shereen, my concern in regards to this is the federal government's got a lot better things to be doing than dictating what kids get served in their school lunch programs. I mean, this really highlights the overreach, I believe, by our federal government, the Congress, and the president at this point into people's daily lives.
Congressman Tom Tiffany is our guest today on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can weigh in as well. Ask your questions at 800-780-9742. Send an email to route51@wpr.org. Plenty of time to get involved in this conversation. There's another bill that caught my eye. You're calling for the president to close the Chinese consulate in New York City and expel all the diplomatic personnel assigned to that mission. Also, the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office. Why is that an issue that is central for you?
I thought that this would be a proportionate response to, we found out that the Communist Chinese government has established police stations in America. I mean, think about it. Police stations by a foreign country on American soil? That is unacceptable. But it is this aggressiveness that the Communist Chinese government has had. I mean, let's go back and look at the history of this. Hong Kong, which was a free place just when the British had it up until, 1999 when that was turned over, Hong Kong is no longer free. And it's because the Communist Chinese government has really brought down the hammer on the people in Hong Kong. And so you have that going on. You have the ethnic Uyghurs that are enslaved in Western China. You have the constant threats to Taiwan. I mean, you see this aggressive behavior that's been going on, and it goes on here in America also. And we're trying to send a clear message to the Communist Chinese that don't intrude into our sovereign soil here in America. And by the way, these police stations are being established around the world. Western Europe has them. One of the police stations, I believe, we found is in Minneapolis. And so they've been establishing these, and it's primarily, I believe at this point, it's primarily to intimidate Chinese that are in our country that do no longer want to be under the thumb of the communist Chinese. They are keeping tabs on them is what they're doing. That's unacceptable on American soil.
We will go to the phone now. We have Ernest from Hayward with us. Hi, Ernest. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is concerning the farm bill that's due to be renewed in September. Why can't the farm bill and the food bill be separate pieces of legislation? This would allow us to focus on the outrageous subsidies being given to corporate agriculture due to the log rolling, where, okay, we'll get the food bill if you give us the farm bill, and vice versa. It would allow us to focus on what is really happening with the farm bill.
Thanks, Ernest. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. So I think what Ernest is driving at there is to, so you have the farm programs that are in the farm bill, but you also have, for example, the SNAP funding that's in there. So some people refer to that as food stamps, and that is a massive part of the farm bill. And there are people on both sides of the aisle that would like to see a split in those two things, where they be handled separately, where the farm programs, like, for example, if there's the grain programs, the dairy programs, and all the rest, that be handled in one bill, and then you separate the food side of it, SNAP, and those type of benefits, that you separate them out. I think one of the things that I would like to see in regards to this is with the SNAP benefits that there be some means testing in regards to it, because that program, the food stamp benefits are by far the biggest part of the farm bill at this point in terms of the cost to the American people. And we should make sure only those that truly should be getting SNAP and the food benefits are getting them.
How do you determine who really should be getting them? I guess, you know, what guidelines do you say who should be getting these benefits and who should not?
Yeah, so when I mentioned means testing, you know, there would be an income test to it. That would be one way in which that could happen. And I think this goes back to encouraging people to work. If you saw the advisory referendum that we had here in Wisconsin back in April, 80-20. I mean, that means people across the political spectrum are saying, if you can work, you really need to work. And I think it goes back to that whole mentality. We need to make sure that people, if they can provide for themselves, they should. Because the worst thing that we can do for a human being is make them dependent on government. I understand that there's times people need a hand up, and nothing wrong with that, but it shouldn't be forever.
You are listening to Congressman Tom Tiffany on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well. Our number is 800-780-9742. You can also send an email with your questions to Route 51 at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward. U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany is with us today. What would you like to know about how Congress works, or do you have a concern in the 7th District that you'd like our congressman to know about? You can email us, route51 at wpr.org, or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Tom, so much of the work that you do happens in committees. Which committees are you a part of, and how does that all get assigned?
Yeah, so I sit on two committees, Natural Resources and the Judiciary Committee. And so I asked for the Natural Resources Committee as soon as I was elected. If you remember, it was special election, May of 2020. It was one of the first things that I asked for, is to get on the Natural Resources Committee. Was ultimately able to do that. And by the way, I believe one of the best chairmen in this current Congress is the chair of Natural Resources, Bruce Westerman. Very low-key. He's a professional forester. He has a forestry degree from Yale, and so very knowledgeable about forestry issues. But he's also an engineer, and so he has this great background. And he's quite low key. And I really like how he runs the committee. I mean, he's got his opinions, and he's strong in those. But he's he does a very good job of chairing the committee. And then I sit on the Judiciary Committee, which Representative Jordan asked me to be on right after that special election, and I've served on that ever since. That really wasn't a natural for me. I don't have a law degree. And as I said to Representative Jordan, I don't have a law degree. I never served on the Judiciary Committee in the state legislature. And he's like, don't worry about it. We would like to have you on the committee. And so much is happening in judiciary these days. When you look at the censorship issues with like the big tech companies, Section 230, all that that's going on, we have oversight in regards to the border. And, of course, the FBI. And so there's so much action in the Judiciary Committee. So both committees really keep us busy.
Are you enjoying the committee work? I mean, even not having that background?
Yeah, the committee committee work is really interesting. And it's been a steep learning curve with Judiciary. But I've got a really good staff that do a terrific job of preparing and stuff like that. It's really interesting. When I come into Washington, D.C. each week, and we usually have a four-day week, coming in either on Monday or Tuesday. But from the time I land at Reagan, every minute of every day is scheduled for me. I mean, you are just going constantly. And a lot of that is the committee work that you're referencing, and you're correct. Much of the work happens in committee.
As part of that committee work, you spent some time in Yosemite recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, last week, Natural Resources Committee had a hearing out in Yosemite, and was in regards to, in particular, the wildfires that have been going on now for a number of years in the West, and really has decimated significant areas of the West. When you look at Yosemite, this is the first time I've had a chance to go there. There are tens of thousands of acres that have been burned out in Yosemite, and it just does not look good. Yosemite is a beautiful place. I mean, if you get a chance to go. I mean, it is really, it's iconic here in America, a terrific national park. But one of the big concerns that we have is saving our sequoias. And many of the sequoias in the West are in Yosemite. We've lost 20% of them over the last couple of years to the wildfires. People used to think, we heard from the biologists and others out there on our trip that they didn't believe sequoias would burn down.
Really?
Because they survive fire very well. Well, we found out over the last couple of years they can. And the reason they're burning is because of improper management. What you have is, the big tall trees, as long as they're there, they can survive the fire. But we've been allowing smaller trees to grow up under them, and they're serving as a ladder for the fire to get up to the crowns.
Oh, interesting.
And so these smaller trees need to be cut. But there's been all these lawsuits by some of the national environmental groups, in particular headquartered in San Francisco, that have been stopping these trees from being cut underneath the sequoias. Well, now we've lost 20% of them. And we actually have a bill specifically now to save our sequoias and more generally to change our forest management in the West, because there's no reason that we should see these hundreds of thousands of acres burning every year. Fire is part of the landscape in the West, but it doesn't need to burn down such vast tracts as we've seen over the last decade.
We have Tony with us now on the phone from Tomahawk. Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Congressman Tiffany, I know you would want to be fair and balanced about all the issues. And there's been a focus on Hunter Biden, but I'm asking what your focus would be regarding Jared Kushner, who got $2 billion from Saudi Arabia, $2 billion, not million, but billion. And Mnuchin worked in the Trump administration, $1 billion for their private equity work. And these folks were in the administration. They weren't outsiders. They flew on, government jets and all that and negotiated these deals while they were working for us, ostensibly. So,
sure.
Will you investigate them as well?
Thanks, Tony. What do you say to that?
So if they do it outside of government, it's generally legal for them to do it. I'd have to look into that more closely. But to Tony's point, I agree with you that it has been an insider's game out in Washington, D.C. And it's been going on for a long time. And the description of it as the swamp is accurate. And why are six of the wealthiest counties, those right around Washington, D.C., in America at this point? Because they have enriched themselves. There is no doubt about it. The only thing that I ask for is fairness. And so if there's an investigation into Jared Kushner or Steve Mnuchin, I'm fine with that. If that should happen, no problem at all. Just like we're what is happening with Hunter Biden. And so I just believe that there should be fairness. Because let's go back to January 6th of 2021. We found out in the last 2 weeks that they went and deleted all the information that made up the January 6th inquiry in the last Congress. Why would you delete that information? Why wasn't Nancy Pelosi's, her dealings on January 5th and January 6th, her communications, made part of the public record? And so what I try to be is real consistent about this stuff. Let's make sure, it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican, Democrat, or any other flavor, that put the cards on the table. The American people are fair about this, and they'll decide. They'll decide whether there's been wrongdoing that has going on. But there is no doubt that this has been an insider's game in Washington, D.C., and it's why I fight every day for limited government. This is what happens when you have a federal government that has gotten so big. They dictate whether kids can have chocolate milk in schools, and they also dictate people's lives down to the nth degree. That's not how it should work. We need to pull power, which is pulling money out of Washington, D.C. Let's return it to the states and our local communities.
Congressman Tom Tiffany is our guest today. Plenty of time to call and join in the conversation, 800-780-9742. You can email us as well, route51@wpr.org. Circling back to some of the legislation that is being discussed, tell me a little bit about the Justice for Murder Victims Act. What's the issue here?
So there is a statute of limitations, and I didn't study that before we came in for the interview, but I believe generally that bill, there's a statute of limitations where a person could get off with murder. And what we're saying is that that statute of limitations should be changed in certain cases. I'd have to check once again some more details in regards to that. But what we have seen is that some, as a result of some of the modern forensic techniques that are being used to be able to solve murders, that the statute of limitations enters sometimes, and we're saying that perhaps we should adjust that a little bit to make sure that people get justice.
Turning a little closer to home, the Great Lakes Intertribal Council blessed ground this month for a 36-bed residential facility that would support Native American teens struggling with addiction. You've had some concerns about this project. What are those concerns?
Yeah, I've actually been quite critical of it because I don't know for the life of me why the tribes would build this in a rural residential area in western Oneida County. It's not near the sheriff's department. It's not near healthcare facilities. I mean, what I heard from the tribes previously over the previous decade, especially when I served in the legislature, is they wanted to have these healthcare facilities on their tribal property. Now, all of a sudden, they want to put it in rural Oneida County, western Oneida County, where it really doesn't fit. And you have all these neighbors that are out there that have residential, it's a residential neighborhood. Why would you stick that in that place? It really doesn't make much sense to do it in that place. And especially when the tribes have plenty of property, the Great Lakes Intertribal Council is a consortium. I mean, they could put it at any of the tribal facilities. They could put it in Lac du Flambeau. They could put it up at Watersmeet. They could put it in Hayward and the Lac-Couturier Reservation. There's a variety of places to be doing it. Putting it there just seems really odd to me. And I actually believe that I think it violates the zoning for Oneida County. And we'll see what happens when they file for their zoning permit. In regards to that. The other thing we're really concerned about, I believe that they'll ultimately take that land, which is currently fee land, so people are paying property taxes on it, and they're going to turn it into trust land where they don't have to pay property taxes. That's going to drive people's property taxes in Oneida County higher. Now, the representative for the tribe that was at the hearing in Cashin, he said, well, we don't know that we're going to do that, and okay, maybe they don't know that they're going to do that. I will bet you within 5 years, they will try to take that land from fee to trust.
I also want to ask you about the Lac du Flambeau issue. You know, the tribe is maintaining the blockade of some roads. You've spoken out about that quite a bit. you were very critical of the tribe, and the tribal companies are saying, look, this entire situation could have been avoided. I mean, what's happening here, and what should happen here?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's curious to me why previous tribal chairmen, they talk about the expiration of the easements. That was about a decade ago. And they said, this should have been solved. Well, why didn't the tribal council and the tribal chairman talk about that and try to solve it? I don't understand why that didn't happen. But specifically in regards to closing those roads down, there were tribal transportation monies that were used on those roads, and it is illegal to close a road when you have used federal money for those purposes. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has been criticized both by us as well as the Lac du Flambeau tribe, they have not done their job in regards to this. They should have told the tribe that, hey, this is tribal transportation money that's been used here. This is illegal to close down roads. And by the way, I don't think tribal members are all in lockstep on this. I've been hearing from a number of Lac du Flambeau tribal members that are like, we don't think this is any way to treat our neighbors.
What do you think is going to happen? I mean, how do you think it's going to resolve?
I hope cooler heads prevail. It greatly concerns me, though. The attorney that represents the tribe lives over in the Twin Cities. He's a Minneapolis-St. Paul attorney, and he doesn't have to deal with the neighbors here. I think he's so far removed, and he's just simply playing hardball. And I think that neighbors, whether they be tribal members or non-tribal members, I think some of those tribal members need to step forward and say, you know what? This isn't how we want to lead our lives. This isn't how we want to treat our neighbors. And we'll see what happens. There's a tribal election coming up. We'll see what happens this fall in regards to that.
We had an email from Jim who is asking this. Two marker bills in the Senate, the Fair Credit for Farmers Act and the Farmland for Farmers Act, would help current and beginning farmers gain access to USDA credit and fair access farmland by limiting farmland ownership by investment firms, retirement funds, private investors like Bill Gates, who see farmland as nothing more than an investment. Jim wants to know, isn't it important to have farmers living and working their land and contributing to their communities as opposed to allowing farmland to become little more than an investment opportunity for non-farmers? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a really good point that Jim brings up. And I have been thinking about this for years, including when I was in the state legislature. How do we incentivize and encourage young people to be able to get into farming? And how do we incentivize those retiring farmers, that 60-year-old farmer who is like, by the way, I have some siblings that are of that age, and the knees and hips are starting to give out and all the rest. And how do we incentivize them to transfer their land to these young people that want to start out rather than just, I mean, they want to get their money, right? And they want to be assured they're going to get their money. And that's hard for a young farmer to do with the enormous investment that goes in. So what do they say? They sell to the big farmer next door. And I agree that there's a real public policy concern here, and that we need to try to solve this. Because, yes, we do not want the Bill Gateses of the world. We do not want the Chinese communists. We do not want these huge hedge funds to own all the farmland in America. It is not good for America for that to happen. Finding that public policy solution, though, has been the real challenge. I'm not completely familiar with the couple bills that Jim mentioned here, but I'm sure happy to take a look at it. I do agree with him, though, with the policy goal.
I want to ask you about another issue. We had a discussion here on Route 51 a couple of weeks ago about the Kids Online Safety Act. So this is, of course, regarding kids being on social media, regulating whether or not kids should have parental permission to be on social media. There are some state bills that have passed in other states. Utah, I believe, was the first to pass their own version of this, and this is now being discussed at the federal level. What do you think about regulating online social media use for kids?
I think there may be a place for that. I think, though, when you step back and look at the big picture, I think we need to go back after Section 230. Section 230, passed in the late 90s, gave the protections to the social media companies where, I mean, they basically have unlimited liability protections. And let me give you a quick example. Facebook, for example, they are used as a platform to facilitate illegal immigration on the Mexican border. And they've actually touted it. That should be an illegal act. I actually believe it is an illegal act to use your business, because if any other business did that, let's say U-Haul said, well, we're going to bring in illegal immigrants via our U-Haul trucks. Well, that's illegal here in America. I believe what Facebook is doing there is illegal also. But I think the Section 230 needs to be rewritten, and I think there needs to be some liability that is enforced with the social media companies, that they be responsible for some of the things they're doing, whether we talk about illegal immigration, kids and seeing the stuff they're but also pornography. It is the primary driver of pornography here in America, and it's not healthy for people. I think this goes back to Section 230 being rewritten. And by the way, us in the Judiciary Committee have authority on that.
Sure, sure. Also, in a previous Route 51 program, we spoke with Republican State Senator Jesse James. This was just a few weeks ago. He's introduced a bill at the state level that would allow DACA recipients to be eligible to become local police officers and county deputies. I know this is a state issue, but with the challenges that local law enforcement agencies are having in recruitment, I'm curious about your thoughts on this issue and that proposed legislation. He's having a difficult time getting other fellow Republicans to buy in on it. He's close, he said, but there's pushback there.
Well, first of all, someone should be, they should have to be in our country legally, and they should have the legal papers to prove that in order to be a policeman here in America. I think the bigger concern from my standpoint, though, is that we have disincentivized work ever since March of 2020, when the COVID restrictions were put in place, when we had about 5 million people in America that left the workforce. Most have not come back to the workforce. The estimates I see from like Bureau of Labor Statistics and others is that about 3 to 5 million people have not come back into the workforce, and we've disincentivized them from doing that. We have, with the benefits that are out there from the federal government, some of them that are still there. We need to make sure, it goes back to what I talked at the top, 80% of the people in the state of Wisconsin say, if you're able-bodied, you should work. We've got 3 to 5 million people in America. That's the first thing that we should be doing, is incentivizing them to work.
Congressman Tom Tiffany is our guest today, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guest today is U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany. You can join the conversation, too. The number to call, 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to Route51@WPR.org. Tom stays with us for the rest of the hour. But for those listening who might have a question after the program and they want to get in touch, what's the best way to reach you if they have a specific question?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways. Certainly use email. You can just go to our website and find that. But a local phone number is 715-298-9344. We'll research that. And by the way, something that we've been kind of touting in our newsletter, we put out a weekly newsletter called the Tiffany Telegram. Doesn't cost anything. If you want to see what's happening in Washington, D.C. and in the 7th Congressional District, we put that out every week. But we've returned over $1 million to the people of the 7th Congressional District in this session as a result of our work, you know, like with veterans, Social Security benefits, just those various federal programs. And my staff really takes great pride in following through on those. I can't tell you how many visa questions we've had or help people with their visas. You know, just all of those things that have to deal with the federal government. Don't hesitate to contact us, because we will help you out. And by the way, I've had a couple people contact me that have said, you know, Tom, I don't vote for you, but here's the problem, and I'm hoping you'll help me. You don't have to worry about that. I represent all 750,000 people that are in the 7th Congressional District. We will help you, regardless of whether you vote for me or not.
Okay. Well, you're getting ready to for the next session. As you're preparing, what do you feel like the general mood is in Congress? I mean, is it hopeful? Is it argumentative? What's the feeling?
You know, I think when you have divided government, as we have with the House being Republican, the Senate being Democrat, you know, there's just a whole lot of posturing that's going on. I think the biggest story of the month of August, you know, we've got all the stuff that captures headlines and whatever. But to me, the biggest story of the month of August was the downgrade of the United States credit rating. Only the second time in the history of our country. It is like, so think about it as an individual. If your credit score was downgraded, most people would go, whoa, why did that happen? And they would be concerned about it. I think the American people should be concerned the same way. This is America's credit score, and it's been downgraded for only the second time. And when you see the things like higher interest rates, we had three regional bank failures in 2023. We have over $1 trillion of personal credit card debt for the first time in the history of our country. You have all these markers that are out there at this point that are saying we're going in the wrong direction, especially fiscally. And to me, that should be the overarching question, because it's going to affect us in so many different ways, including we're going to have to start paying higher interest on the debt that we have, which is over $32 trillion. I mean, this really bodes ill for America. And think about all the important programs, Social Security, Medicare, stuff like that. At some point, it jeopardizes them. And so we really need to get our fiscal house in order. And that's going to be the big question here as we get to the end of September, when the fiscal year ends and we're supposed to have the budget bills in place for the next fiscal year.
Now, you mentioned the divided government. What's that like? How do you navigate that?
So you try to work together to try to come to solutions. And it can be real challenging. I mean, imagine being Speaker McCarthy and with trying to herd 435 people, especially. I mean, think about the people in our conference. I belong to the House Freedom Caucus, and we really take a hard line in regards to these fiscal issues and some others. And so it makes it difficult for our speaker sometimes to be able to get that common ground. And that's what happened when we had the debt limit increase. You know, it ended up, he had to get Democrat votes in order to get the debt limit to increase. And I voted against it because $4 trillion more now over the next couple of years through January 2025. And we've already spent $1 trillion more in just the 2 months since the debt limit bill passed. And so it's a real challenge to be able to navigate these things. But for the life of me, if we don't get our fiscal house in order, it's going to be bad for all Americans, regardless of their political stripes.
Speaking of money, the war in Ukraine is still going on. Earlier this year, you were one of 10 congressmen to vote against sending further aid to Ukraine at that time. Has your view on this shifted? Do you think we should be paying for the war in Ukraine?
No, I've been voting against it, and I really have great concerns of getting in there. So first of all, we understand who the bad guy is here, and that's Vladimir Putin in Russia. But how we're going about it, I believe President Biden handled this very poorly from the very start. When he shut down Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL, with his very first executive action on January 20th of 2021, he sent a signal to the world we were no longer going to be energy independent. That gave power to Russia. That gave them leverage. And then when you fast forward to the disastrous pullout from Afghanistan, which we just acknowledged the 2-year anniversary of that in the last week, that disastrous pullout from Afghanistan, it showed the rest of the world we were going to be weak. I believe that emboldened President Putin. And whether you like President Trump or not, he is the first president in decades that did not get us in another war. And we have, President Biden, through weakness, has sent a message to the despots and dictators around the world that America is no longer going to be strong. And that is what emboldened Vladimir Putin to invade Ukraine. We have to get back to a strong America. And that includes both militarily, but also in regards to our fiscal condition. And part of that is being energy independent and having a strong American economy. We do not have that right now.
Pat from Three Lakes has a question for you. Pat wants to know, she said that there are a lot of Republicans that don't believe Joe Biden is the legitimate president of the U.S. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I get that question regularly from,
I'm sure.
From people that are, and it's actually, I hope Pat isn't doing this. Most people that ask me that question are trying to trap me. Joe Biden is the president of the United States of America, And for better or for worse, that's the case. I can tell you, Pat, as we go into the 2024 election and we see the impact of Bidenomics with inflation continuing to run at numbers we haven't seen since the 1970s. We are no longer energy independent. Our border is wide open. Fentanyl poisonings are at a record. And if you talk to sheriffs on the southern border, they will tell you it's directly tied to the fentanyl that's coming into America. There's no reason for that to be happening. If we had a secure border, all you got to do is talk to sheriffs like Mark Daniels, Cochise County, south of Tucson, who I've talked to multiple times and said under oath that this is what's killing young people, is the fentanyl that's coming into our country. So if you like all those things, you know, you're going to vote for President Biden once again. But I think our country's going in the wrong direction. And when you see that credit downgrade, only the second time in the history of the United States of America, we are off track.
Beverly would like you to weigh in on redistricting with Fair Maps in Wisconsin, the Fair Map issue that has been spoken about for quite a few years now. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so it's going to be real interesting to see what the state Supreme Court does at this point. The new justice, Janet Protasiewicz, said that she believes that the maps are illegitimate. She may have used a different term, but it was basically illegitimate. And so it sounds like the court, state Supreme Court, is going to take that up. I believe Judge Protasiewicz should recuse herself from this case because she has explicitly talked about how she would decide the case before being a judge. And I believe that breaks her oath to the courts. But we will see what happens if they're going to take that issue on.
Yeah. We had an email from Mark in Wisconsin Rapids. Mark says, you've spoken at length about fairness and not having the government dictating milk choices for children, for example. What about the government dictating what a woman can do for her health care choices and for dictating to parents how to raise their child in terms of gender choice? How do those compare?
Did I hear you correctly say parents dictating their children's gender choice?
Dictating to parents how they raise their child in terms of gender choice. That's what the email says.
So first of all, I believe parents should have that decision to make. I think this is really broiling out in Virginia now. Where I believe Governor Youngkin is saying that you have to contact parents if you're going to do a gender change for an underage child. And I agree with that. Parents should be involved with that decision if that's going to happen.
What about in a situation where parents are unfit to make those choices? You know, not everybody lives in a great home. They don't have, you know, a supportive family life. What about cases like that?
Yeah, I think we ultimately have to go back to parents. I mean, if you can show that the parents are unfit and you can take that child away from the parents, that becomes another story. But that's a pretty rare case that happens. But I just feel quite strongly in regards to men should not play girls' sports. Men should not go in women's bathrooms. There are two sexes. And, you know, if you make this decision as an adult, that's your decision. But as someone who is a child, that decision should not be being made by a teacher, by a school, by someone else other than the parents. The parents should be making that decision.
Tom Tiffany is our guest. Still time to call, 800-780-9742. Email route51 at WPR.org. What about the first part of Mark's question? He wanted to know your position on healthcare choices for women. So the abortion issue.
Well, I think we should have more healthcare choices. I mean, this is part of the set aside abortion for a second. This is where Obamacare has taken us. I mean, I talk to both family and friends who are saying it's much longer wait times in order to get appointments with their doctors. This is a result of Obamacare and moving more and more decision making to the federal level for healthcare choices. So I believe we should be offering more healthcare choices to all Americans. In regards to the abortion issue, I mean, that's going to be decided by the people at this point. I believe we should do everything we can to protect the life and health of both babies and mothers. But I know one thing that I do not stand for. Every Democrat member of Congress in the last Congress, under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, they voted to have abortion unlimited to 9 months. To have abortions in the final trimester, for that to be legal, that's barbaric. Now, I think the American people are somewhere in the middle there. where that is. I mean, I voted for a 20-week bill 6 or 7 years ago when I was in the state legislature. But that is unconscionable that we would allow an abortion just before birth of a child. I think that should be unacceptable in a civil society.
Let's shift over to the Donald Trump issue. You brought this up. That whether or not people like Donald Trump and whether or not the president is the president. We also talked about the impeachment process earlier. Mm-hmm. How about indictments? How important are the indictments Donald Trump is facing when it comes to his viability as a candidate and future president?
I mean, you'd have to ask people. I'm sure there's lots of polling that's going on in regards to that. I mean, the problem I have with the indictments is they're criminalizing speech. You may strongly disagree with what Donald Trump says. And by the way, most Democrats, I think, do. There's a few Republicans that do. Strongly disagree with some of the things that he says. But we shouldn't be criminalizing speech. Because if we're going to go down this path, let's go back to Stacey Abrams in 2018. When she was defeated for governor, she never acknowledged that she lost that race. Why didn't the Fulton County District Attorney charge her for doing basically the same thing Donald Trump did in denying the 2020 election? Stacey Abrams denied the 2018 election. She has never acknowledged that she lost that race. Why isn't she being charged? She made comments like that. So let's stop criminalizing speech. This should be a decision by the American people. Let them vote in 2024 for who they want for president.
Tom Tiffany is our guest today. Still a few minutes left. In your recent communication with constituents, you highlighted a recent trip to the Superior region with four of your congressional colleagues touring various locations like Hibbard Renewable Energy Center, the Douglas County Forest. And you mentioned that a common theme throughout was how federal regulations are causing uncertainties for many industries in the region. And that's why you co-sponsored the RAINS Act that was passed by the House. Can you tell us a little bit about that legislation?
Yeah, so the RAINS Act sets a threshold. I think it's about $100 million that if there's a rule passed by the agencies, by the executive branch, and it's going to cost the American people more than $100 million, it has to have a vote of Congress. So in other words, it's us being representatives of the people. So that's ultimately what it does. But it's jeopardizing so many of these projects that are going on. I mean, as a result of the permitting process, we are seeing projects, including infrastructure projects, bridges, things like that, that are taking 10 to 15 years to get the permits. Why is it so costly for these infrastructure projects? In large part, it's the lengthy, long-lasting permitting process, and we should be streamlining that more. And we should make sure that it isn't bureaucrats that are deciding what the law should be when a rule is going to cost us over $100 million as the American people. Congress should have to vote on that also. That's what the RAINS Act does.
Where does this stand right now in the legislative process? Has it been taken up by the Senate or will it?
I believe we passed that through the House. I'd have to double check that.
Okay.
I believe we passed it through the House. So it would be sitting in the Senate at this point. And I'm hopeful we're able to do that. We did that in the state legislature a few years ago when I was there. And it's good because it puts the onus back on your elected representatives. So us elected representatives, Shereen, can't go back and say, well, it's just the bureaucrats that did that. That's why this thing got put in place, this law got put in place. No, it should be our elected representatives that decide these things. And then the people can say, I like this or I don't like this. I'm voting for them again. I'm not voting for them. Make us accountable.
We've got about a minute left in our time together, and I want to ask you, a couple weeks ago you announced that you will not challenge Democrat Tammy Baldwin for her U.S. Senate seat. What led to that decision?
Ultimately, I decide each election cycle where I believe I can do the most good for the people of the state of Wisconsin. I believe it's best to stay home in the 7th Congressional District. Hopefully people will return me in 2024. I do believe Senator Baldwin is vulnerable in some ways, though. She's a career politician, started out in Dane County politics on the Dane County Board in the 1980s, and she's been in politics ever since. That's part of the problem in America, people staying too long. And also, she's been a rubber stamp for President Biden. She votes for everything President Biden's been doing, and that's why America is in the fiscal trouble it's in, and it's why we have fentanyl poisonings that are at records at this point, and we're no longer energy independent.
Once again, that phone number, if people want to contact your office?
715-298-9344.
Tom, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you giving me an hour of your time, Shireen.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, extending a sincere thanks one more time to our guest, Congressman Tom Tiffany. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Rick Ryer, both of whom worked as on-air producers today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at route51@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you join us. But until then, we're headed out of town.